morning from the Talking Information Centre. This is Alison Davies on Wednesday, April the 8th, reading from the USA Today. One of the main stories from the front page, the Iran war. US and Iran engaged in meme warfare. Foes are using social media to shape perceptions, by Kate Perez. As it continues into its second month, the Iran war has moved from the Middle East to social media platforms, where memes, pop culture clips and video game visuals are influencing how the conflict is perceived. From SpongeBob SquarePants jokes to video game mashups, US government accounts and pro-Iranian voices are trading viral posts that mock opponents, rally supporters and shape opinion. Psychologists say the trend, sometimes called memetic warfare, can make military action feel controlled, playful, or even heroic, while softening its real-world consequences. These memes normalize a hyper-masculine, militarized response and encourage people to automatically accept policies that would look very different in a sober news briefing, said media psychologist and director of the Media Psychology Center, Pamela Rutledge. The White House's official social media pages frequently feature animated content, pop culture references, sports clips, and iconic American imagery, including bald eagles and the U.S. flag. The posts have ramped up with the war's start, becoming more patriotic and pointed. Some posts use familiar songs like Lynyrd Skynyrd's Free Bird, with dramatic beat drops timed to clips of explosions. Others adopt popular video games, including remakes of Nintendo's Wii Sports, where scenes like a golf swing or an arrow shot end with footage of explosions. Some of those posts have earned hundreds of thousands of views and likes, with many accompanied by captions about continuing objectives or American strength. While Iran's central government accounts have not posted memes, some Iranian embassies and pro-Iranian social media accounts have responded with their own content, criticizing the US government. Posts from Iranian embassies in Lebanon, Afghanistan and South Africa include cartoons depicting President Trump lighting himself on fire or standing beside a damaged Air Force One. Pro-Iranian accounts have also created memes that counter US messaging. One ex-account has drawn attention for animated AI-generated videos depicting Trump as a Lego-style character, appearing stressed or screaming as Iran attacks US boats. For the United States, the videos help create narratives that paint the war as controlled and winnable while making it look like play. By flooding feeds with sizzle reels of gaming clips, superhero memes and dominance jokes, these campaigns prime people, especially young men, to see war through a lens of inevitable, even desirable, heroic excitement. That makes policies feel right without anyone ever seeing the boots-on-the-ground reality. While there is a physical battle underway, Rutledge said the memes also signal a battle of perception online by shaping who is cast as the hero and who is framed as the enemy. A good meme triggers emotion, humor, outrage, moral judgment, or group affiliation, Rutledge said. Humor lowers defenses, suspends critical analysis, and enhances social bonding. Heroic and dominance cues make the message feel morally right. That's a powerful mix if you're trying to sell a war to an anxious, overloaded audience. The White House's posts rely on what Rutledge calls cultural containers, or shared references audiences already understand and feel connected to, including SpongeBob SquarePants, Wii Sports, Pixar films, Call of Duty and Marvel characters. Linking familiar symbols to war imagery can overpower new information, Rutledge said, sanitizing the message with nostalgia while trivializing violence and human life. While humor has long been used to critique and cope with crises, the impact changes when the messaging comes from a government, said Adrian Pershod, an associate professor at Florida State University. If people are naturally coming to these memes, it's telling you something about the nature of society, right? It's telling you something about the way people are feeling about it. When it's coming from the government, though, you don't get that aspect of kind of societal commentary because it's coming from people in power. Beyond that, presenting war updates in a joking, meme-driven format can minimize the perceived horror of military action and make it more acceptable to viewers, she added. The idea is to craft a certain message and a certain feeling. We don't want people to think, This is a very serious issue where people are dying, and it's unjust, Vershord said. We don't want people to think that if we want to go over there and fight. It's thoughtful and intentional. Artemis Heads Back After Moon Mission by Eric Legata. The Artemis II astronauts are on their way home, leaving the moon in the rearview mirror, after becoming the first humans in more than 50 years to travel near Earth's celestial neighbor, setting an all-time distance record and completing the most important leg of their historic mission. The test flight will pave the way for a possible 2028 moon landing. The Artemis II astronauts traveled further from Earth than any humans ever have, 252,756 miles, according to NASA. The previous record was set in 1970 during the infamous Apollo 13 mission, which reached a distance of 248,000 miles. The Artemis II astronauts passed that milestone before 2 o'clock Eastern Time on April 6th, and then went thousands of miles further, swooping around the far side of the moon. The Orion spacecraft came as close as 4,000 miles to the lunar surface. That altitude allowed the crew to see the full disk of our celestial neighbor as they witnessed lunar sights that no other humans, not even the Apollo astronauts, have experienced in person. During the 7-hour close approach known as a lunar flyby, the crew astronauts Reid Wiseman, Christina Koch, and Victor Glover of NASA, as well as Jeremy Hansen of the Canadian Space Agency, made observations of the moon's far side, which is permanently faced away from Earth. They relayed these observations in real time to a global live stream. The crew also came up with two names for craters on the moon. They proposed Integrity, the name they gave to their capsule for a crater on the far side of the moon. And the crew proposed the name Carol, the name of Wiseman's late wife and mother of their two daughters, for a bright spot on the moon, on the near side of the boundary with the far side, which can be seen at times from Earth. Carol died in 2020 of cancer at age 46. Hansen's voice broke as he spoke at that moment, and Wiseman and Koch could be seen wiping away tears. The feed went briefly silent as all four of the astronauts moved into a group hug. To top off an incredible day of space travel, the Artemis II crew witnessed a sublime solar eclipse, visible only to them and no one back on Earth. "We just went sci-fi," Glover said during the roughly hour-long eclipse. "It just looks unreal." As they approached the moon, the astronauts heard a message Apollo 8 and Apollo 13 astronaut Jim Lovell recorded for them before he died last year. "Welcome to my old neighborhood. I'm proud to pass that torch on to you," Lovell continued. "It's a historic day, and I know how busy you'll be, but don't forget to enjoy the view." With all that happening on April 6th, it's no surprise that yesterday was scheduled to be essentially a day off. The astronauts are now making a 4-day journey back to Earth, using our planet's gravity to naturally slingshot or pull them back home, negating the need for propulsion or much fuel. As of the morning of yesterday, the moon was about 25,700 miles behind the spacecraft, with Earth still 242,100 miles away, according to NASA's online tracker. Once Orion blazes through Earth's atmosphere, a protective heat shield will be cast off to make way for parachutes to deploy and slow the vehicle. The capsule will then make a water landing, likely on April 10th in the Pacific Ocean near California, off the coast of San Diego. Once the craft is in the water, 5 orange airbags will inflate around the top of the spacecraft and flip the capsule into an upright position. The crew is expected to exit the vehicle onto a U.S. Navy recovery vessel within about 2 hours. Battle brews over ballots in California. Seizure by gubernatorial candidate looms large by Josh Meyer. A legal battle is playing out in California between Riverside County Sheriff Chad Bianco and Democrats who say the Republican gubernatorial candidate's seizure of more than 650,000 ballots is a political stunt that undermines political trust in voting. Bianco, a staunch supporter of President Trump, denies that. He says he's just doing his job in investigating allegations brought by a conservative citizen group in Riverside County in a special election in California in November of last year. Voting rights experts across the political spectrum say the case could have nationwide implications as other Trump supporters and conservative activists push similar and largely unfounded accusations of electoral irregularities in an effort to get law enforcement to investigate them. In an exclusive March 31st interview with USA Today, Bianco said the publicity surrounding his investigation has prompted elections and law enforcement officials and conservative groups to contact his office to see how they can launch similar inquiries. "There are a lot of people reaching out to us from other states, from other counties than Riverside, saying the same thing's happening here," Bianco said. "We have former poll workers saying there's massive fraud going on, but nobody is looking into it." Hans von Spakovsky, a former Department of Justice official who is now an elections expert with the organizing Advancing American Freedom, which advocates for conservative policies, supported Bianco's efforts to investigate the claims of a ballot differential. "Any time there's a discrepancy in ballot totals, it should be investigated to find out whether there were any mistakes, errors, or intentional misconduct in the election," he said. But Pamela Smith, who heads the voting rights group Verified Voting, said Bianco's two separate seizures of hundreds of boxes of ballots in March seem more like an attention grab than an effort to actually determine whether there was any kind of misconduct. "This is somebody who's running for office in California, and probably more people know his name today than they did a few weeks ago," Smith told USA Today. Voters passed Proposition 50, a ballot measure to redraw congressional districts in Democrats' favor, 64-36% in the election in question. In Riverside County, it was 57-43%. The state certified the election, and no one questioned its outcome until January. That's when Bianco says he was contacted by a conservative activist group called the Riverside Election Integrity Team that had done its own audit of the vote. County records show the registrar of voters initially logged in the receipt of 611,000 mail ballots. But when you add up the yes and the no votes, it comes up to 657,000 ballots, Bianco said. That adds up to a $46,000 vote difference. "There's no explanation for why it's different, so we started looking into it." Bianco's allegations have been disputed by county election officials, who say the real discrepancy was only 103 ballots. They said such claims were based on a misinterpretation of unofficial versus certified ballot totals. Smith said Bianco was comparing apples to oranges. "The lower number comes from preliminary ballot intake logs that are unofficial and incomplete," she said, "and don't take into consideration things like late-arriving ballots, provisional ballots, and cured ballots, with questionably matching signature issues resolved. The higher number, according to Smith, includes all of those into one complete, verified, and officially certified vote total. There are a variety of reasons why they come in later that wouldn't be included in the initial count," Smith said. "If you collaborate with the county, they can walk you through all of that." Even if such a discrepancy existed, Smith said, "the United States, and especially California, have a multi-layered system in place for checking election results that Bianco could have used to verify the results. That includes post-election audits, ballot accounting and reconciliation procedures, and recounts that can focus on one specific precinct or the whole state," she said. "So if they say they had questions about a particular set of numbers, they could have had the election official do a recount. There is recourse through normal channels." Instead, Bianco got Riverside County Superior Court Judge Jay Keel to sign a series of warrants beginning in mid-February, authorizing the sheriff to seize the ballots tied to the November election. His department initially seized about 1,000 boxes of ballot materials, including 650,000 ballots from the Riverside County Registrar of Voters, and later seized another tranche after California Attorney General Rob Bonta, a Democrat, told him to cease and desist. The court also ordered the appointment of a special master to oversee a ballot count. Bonta, the Attorney General, has disputed that, saying the warrant didn't appoint a special master to conduct such a recount. California isn't the only place where fights and investigations over ballot counting are taking place. The FBI on January the 28th seized 656 boxes of election materials in Fulton County, Georgia, from the 2020 presidential election, widening President Trump's latest quest to recast his election loss to Joe Biden as a product of fraud. Federal authorities also subpoenaed records from the Arizona Senate last month related to its recount of Maricopa County's 2020 ballots. The main story from the USA Today. In U.S. territories, a lack of identity. Many residents feel like outsiders who serve their country but have limited legal rights. By Carissa Waddick. Kevin Mendez can still smell the scent of freshly baked bread wafting out of his local panaderia. He still hears the nighttime chirps of the Corky Frog and pictures the skateboard-toting children crowding palm tree-lined streets at the end of a school day. When he closes his eyes, he dreams of his slice of America. Mendez left his hometown, Fajardo, Puerto Rico, in 2020 to teach high school English in Maryland. But since the move, he said he's felt more than ever like an outsider. People view Puerto Rico as kind of an object, the 29-year-old said. It has the tropical vibes that people can go visit, but at the end of the day, they see it as lesser than. The lack of understanding makes him question his sense of belonging. I know I'm a part of America, but I feel even more Puerto Rican living in the U.S., he said. As the United States celebrates 250 years of independence, residents from the nation's five inhabited territories told USA Today they feel perpetually conflicted about their identity as Americans, given their distinct cultures and lack of full legal rights. Some expressed a desire for greater sovereignty and said recent U.S. military operations of Venezuela and Iran have rekindled long-simmering concerns about their lack of political representation in the federal government. The U.S. territories consistently have the highest rates of military enlistment per capita anywhere in the United States. Signs of the country's growing military presence abroad can be felt in Puerto Rico through the rumblings of military aircraft overhead, in the Virgin Islands, through the sight of Navy ships offshore, in Guam, through the influx of troops stationed on its bases, in the northern Marianas Islands, through the construction of new military training infrastructure, and in American Samoa, through murmurs of the deployment of loved ones. Those living on the island say the increased military operations have brought fears about security, environmental degradation, and economic trouble. To the mainland, we might be seen as a strategic asset. We might be seen as the tip of the spear, said Dean Manglona, who lives on the island of Rhoda in the northern Marianas. But to us, this is home. The chain of 14 islands lies 6,000 miles west of Los Angeles, and serves as a defense hub in the Pacific. The territory often feels an outsized impact from the tremors of geopolitical pivots, Manglona said. Sprinkled throughout the Caribbean and the Pacific Ocean, the American territories are often advertised as vacation spots, tropical paradises surrounded by white sand beaches and turquoise blue waters, with five-star resorts dotting their coasts. Each has its own history and culture. The majority populations range from Afro-Caribbean and Latino to Asian, Pacific Islander, and Indigenous. They each face unique challenges. The Northern Marianas' fragile economy, American Samoa's shrinking population, Puerto Rico's housing crisis, the U.S. Virgin Islands' frequent power outages, and Guam's infrastructure strain. Their relationships with the United States also vary. Residents of American Samoa, for instance, are considered U.S. nationals, not U.S. citizens, and lack rights given to other territories. Yet some see the problems these territories face as complications of the government structure under which they exist. The five territories are among 17 regions across the world the United Nations says should be granted self-determination or independence. We occupy a very interesting place in the American imagination, but also in the global imagination, said Hadia Sewer, director of the Virgin Islands Caribbean Cultural Center. Because the U.S. is viewed as a beacon of democracy, it becomes difficult to fully grapple with the position of U.S. territories today. Annexation of the territories in the late 19th and early 20th century followed a history of U.S. expansionism that began with Thomas Jefferson's Louisiana Purchase in 1803. and like other lands that eventually gained statehood, the islands were given no guarantee of eventual political equality. They were added as unincorporated territories, a framework created by the Supreme Court through a series of early 20th century decisions that limited the constitutional protections given to the predominantly black, Asian, and indigenous islands. As part of its reasoning, the court argued that territories were inhabited by alien races, differing from us in religion, customs, laws, methods of taxation, and modes of thought. Legal scholars in recent years have suggested the legal framework used by the Supreme Court in the Inchilla cases was racist and contrary to the Constitution. In 2022, Trump-appointed Justice Neil Gorsuch argued the decisions rested on racial stereotypes and deserve no place in our law. That same year, the Supreme Court declined to hear a case, asking it to overturn the Inchilla cases. Sewer, who has been involved in the discussions about the nation's 250th anniversary, said the territories with their distinctive legal status serve as spaces where we can understand the limits of democracy amid the year's celebrations. Anne Perez-Hattori remembers studying U.S. history textbooks, putting together puzzle maps of the 50 states, and learning about maple trees and squirrels in science classes in elementary school. The textbooks never mentioned her home, Guam. The puzzles didn't stretch wide enough to show its location in the Pacific Ocean, closer to New Zealand than the mainland United States, and Hattori never saw deciduous trees or the puffy-tailed rodents outside her window. From the time we're born, we learn we're American citizens and we go to school, and we're using standard U.S. textbooks. But you're not in any of the books, Hattori said. As you become an adult, you're just kind of used to the disconnection. Hattori saw the United States' influence on the island and its culture as shirts from Macy's and Kmart began replacing the hand-sewn clothes her mother hung in her closet, and the Chamorro people, indigenous to the land, increasingly relied on processed foods like Spam amid military encroachment of farmlands. Today, the U.S. military occupies roughly a third of the island's land and its presence is growing. The military has, over the last decade, been constructing a new base to relocate 5,000 Marines from Japan to Guam. The number of active duty troops in the territory is expected to grow from a 2024 level of 17,000 to nearly 24,000 by 2033. The military presence has shaped life on the island. Julie Noreen Batista moved to Guam from the Philippines when she was 12, after her family received citizenship. In high school, she remembers almost all of her peers taking the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, an aptitude test for enlistment eligibility. Recruiters often chatted to her about joining the Air Force. Because there aren't that many job opportunities on Guam, there's high rates of enlistment in the military straight out of high school, Hattori said. Pretty much every family I know has at least one person in the military. It's just standard, it's the norm. The same is true for many of the territories. The military does not routinely publish enlistment numbers in the territories, but as of 2022, American Samoa had the highest rate of military enlistment of any state or territory, according to the DHHS. Sabrina Siltoi Mahuka grew up in Pago Pago, the capital of American Samoa, on a mountain covered in lush greenery and naturally growing fruits and vegetables like avocados and mangoes. About half of her family has served in the military in some capacity, including her husband and two of her siblings. People join, she said, to show their pride in being American. We know what it means to be loyal to our sovereign nation, and our commitment to the U.S. is taken very seriously, she said. Any global conflict that happens, it might be thousands of miles away, but for us it's not an abstract concept. It's personal, because so many of our loved ones are serving. None of the five territories have seen specific threats as a result of the war in Iran. Although they're far from the conflict, people living in the territories say they feel vulnerable, both in terms of security risks and economic impacts. During times like these, we're especially mindful that some of our service members, both active duty and reservists, may be called upon to answer the nation's call once again, said American Samoa Governor Polahia Nikalauapula in a March the 4th statement. Like the mainland United States, gas prices in the Pacific territories rose more than a dollar in some places, with residents of Guam paying close to $6 a gallon. Military bases on Guam and the Northern Marianas Islands increased their threat level after the initial attacks on February the 28th. During a time of war, others in the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands said it's hard not to feel like the territories are taken for granted. There's a reason why we are a U.S. territory. We were basically a bargaining chip to serve as a form of national security, said Victoria Simone Bellas, who works for the CNMI Governor's Office. The CNMI, she said, has positioned Congress for years to pass legislation improving travel access to the territory. Most flights to Saipan, the capital of the Northern Marianas, from the mainland United States require a layover in Japan. The issue has gained some traction among members of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who has said it affects service members and contractors who resupply the military bases, but that has led people to question why the need for flights wasn't taken more seriously, when it was just for the people of the CNMI. We're very supportive of the relationship. I think people are still trying to understand how that is reciprocated. Conversations about local relations with the United States can be contentious in the territories. It's one of those issues you avoid at parties because people are going to get into arguments, Tori Van Guam noted. Most people USA Today spoke with said their neighbors widely viewed their association with the United States positively. They talked about the benefits of having a U.S. passport, access to federal funding, and opportunities to move throughout the country. Trump details the risks of the mission in rescuing airmen, Vice Bell Mays Osterman. The risky multi-day mission to rescue two American airmen whose fighter jet was shot down, stranding them in Iranian territory, involved more than 150 aircraft, a close-range gunfight, and a complex CIA-led deception campaign, according to President Trump. The operation to rescue the plane's wounded backseat officer from a cliff crevice in Iran where he'd been hiding for nearly 48 hours involved 155 aircraft and hundreds of personnel, Trump told reporters at a White House news briefing on April 6th. Locating the officer, Trump said, was like finding a needle in a haystack. The F-15E fighter jet was shot down in Iran in the pre-dawn hours of April the 3rd local time, said General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the briefing. Trump said a shoulder-mounted heat-seeking missile hit the U.S. plane. Both airmen on board, a pilot and a weapons systems officer, ejected, landing in Iranian territory miles apart. The U.S. military deployed 21 aircraft within hours of the fighter jet's crash. The planes flew at low altitude over Iran for 7 hours in the daylight before narrowing in on the pilot, facing very, very heavy enemy fire, Trump said. Kane said a close-in gunfight ensued as a search and rescue team comprised of A-10 Warthog planes, personnel recovery planes, helicopters and more entered Iran's airspace. Iranians on the ground shot at the low-flying aircraft as a helicopter scooped up the pilot. We have a helicopter that's got a lot of bullets in it, Trump said. An A-10 plane was hit during that operation and its pilot flew into the airspace of a U.S. allied country, ejected from the plane, and was later recovered safely. The weapons systems officer who sits in the seat behind the pilot in the two-person F-15E plane landed a significant distance away and was alone on the ground in Iran. The stranded officer, an Air Force colonel, scaled a cliff face and sheltered in a crevice, said Trump. The colonel was bleeding rather profusely and treated his own wounds. He was injured quite badly and stranded in an area teeming with Iranian military and local authorities, Trump said. Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth said the colonel's first message, when he was able to activate his emergency transponder on the ground, was "God is good." The daunting challenge of finding the officer was comparable to hunting for a single grain of sand in the middle of the desert. Trump explained that 155 aircraft took part in the mission to pull the officer out. At one point, the military blew up two older planes involved in the operation that had got stuck in the sand in Iranian territory so that Iran could not recover them or access the equipment inside. By midnight, exactly 3 days after that rescue, Iranians will face complete demolition if their government does not open the Strait of Hormuz, Trump said at the briefing. Every bridge in Iran will be decimated, and every power plant in Iran would be out of business, burning, exploding, and never to be used again, he said. striking power plants and water infrastructure in Iran, as Trump also has threatened to do, would take a deep toll on Iran's civilians and likely constitute war crimes, experts say. More than 1,300 Iranians have been killed since the war started on February the 28th. They would be willing to suffer that in order to have their freedom, according to Trump. Hard freeze makes spring feel like winter by Janine Santucci. Tens of millions of Americans awoke to temperatures that felt more like winter than spring yesterday, and forecasters warned of another overnight freeze to come. Freeze warnings extended from the Midwest to the East Coast, including Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, West Virginia, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey. Several areas will also be under a freeze watch or warning the night of April 7th into early April 8th, the National Weather Service warned. Temperatures may drop as low as the 20s. Cold conditions should last through about midweek, with daytime highs in northeast cities, including Boston and New York, remaining in the 40s through today, before a rapid warming begins later in the week. In the Midwest, daytime highs could struggle to get above the 30s. And unsettled weather was threatening slow-moving rain and storms in Florida and a Kona storm in Hawaii. A slow-moving storm system was driving lingering showers and thunderstorms over parts of Florida, helping ease an ongoing drought, but also bringing a risk of flash flooding and hazardous coastal conditions along the eastern part of the state through at least today. The Atlantic coastline will be most at risk for heavy rain, with cities including Miami, Daytona Beach, Orlando and Jacksonville in the targeted region. Rainfall could total between 1 and 3 inches along the Atlantic coast and much of South Florida, with some regions receiving 4 to 6 inches. In some extreme cases where repeated storms move and linger over the same area, up to 12 inches could fall. Another Kona storm is threatening already battered Hawaii, with more heavy rain and flood risks starting late April 7th and through the end of the week. A Kona storm, or a Kona low, is a major weather producer, according to the Weather Service. This week's Kona storm is expected to bring strong winds, widespread heavy rainfall and flooding risks to the state, the Weather Service said. The risk for mudslides also is elevated in areas that are already saturated by noxious storms. Parents charged after child hurt at zoo by Tai Nguyen. The parents of a toddler who was injured after sticking his hand into a wolf enclosure at the Zoo America North American Wildlife Park in Pennsylvania have been charged with child endangerment. The Derry Township Police Department said it's investigating the incident that occurred on April 4th at about 11:35 local time. During the incident, police said an unsupervised 17-month-old child had squeezed through a small opening in a wooden barrier perimeter fence and accessed a restricted area near the wolf exhibit. According to police, the child then reached a primary metal fence enclosure and was injured after putting his hand through the metal fencing. Zoo America previously reported the toddler's age is 18 months old. From the injuries sustained, it appears as though one of the wolves in the enclosure instinctively and naturally grabbed onto the child's hand with its mouth. Several bystanders intervened and helped pull the child away. Following a preliminary investigation and consulting with the Dauphin County District Attorney's Office, police said the toddler's parents, identified as Carrie Sauter, 43, and Stephen Wilson, 61, were charged with endangering the welfare of children. Investigators reviewed evidence that showed them both walking about 25 to 30 feet away from their child to a seating area with benches and appeared to be on their phones while the toddler was near the wolf exhibit. There are signs that advise parents to attend to their children and so forth, said the Derry Township Police Chief in an interview with local television stations. Obviously, they did not follow those instructions. A spokesperson for Hershey Entertainment and Resorts previously confirmed to USA Today that the toddler had crawled under an exterior perimeter fence before he approached the primary metal enclosure of the wolf. A wolf approached and made contact with the child's hand, and this type of response is consistent with natural animal behavior and was not a sign of aggression. At least 8 die after a series of police pursuits across the U.S. by Tai Nguyen. A string of high-speed police car chases resulted in at least 8 deaths and several injuries over a span of less than a week, marking the latest deadly incidents in an upward trend of police pursuit fatalities in the United States. In Texas, police said a man died early on April 5th after fleeing from officers and crashing off the roadway. The Montgomery Advertiser reported that four people died after a driver attempted to evade a state trooper and struck a tree in rural Alabama on April 3rd. In Southern California, authorities said three people were killed in separate incidents last week after local law enforcement tried to pursue two suspects who then collided with other vehicles. Hundreds of people die each year during police pursuits, according to experts and research. The long-standing police practice has faced criticism for years. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2024 found that research spanning from 82 to 2020 suggests an increasing trend of fatalities resulting from police pursuits in the United States. Citing data from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, a report noted that there were more than 2,200 fatal vehicle crashes involving police pursuit just from 2015 to 2020. The report recommended that law enforcement agencies only conduct pursuits when a violent crime has been committed and the suspect poses an imminent threat. While officers' decisions to initiate or continue a pursuit are driven by an understandable desire to catch a fleeing suspect, this desire sometimes results in excessive risk-taking and negative consequences for officers, innocent bystanders, the motorist being pursued, and any passengers in either vehicle, the report states. In a news release, the Fort Worth Police Department said officers were involved in a vehicle pursuit that resulted in a fatal crash at about 2:34 a.m. on April 5th. Captain Jeremy Burkett, a spokesperson for the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency, confirmed to the Montgomery Advertiser that four people died after the driver allegedly tried to evade a state trooper in Spike County. Tykevious Russell, 27, was driving with three passengers in his 2022 Hyundai Elantra. The passengers were aged 27, 24, and a 17-year-old. The incident occurred at about 11:57 p.m. on April the 3rd, when Russell's vehicle left the roadway and struck a tree while trying to evade a trooper. In opinion, why can't Trump quit NATO? Ask Rubio by Chris Brennan. President Trump's little excursion into war with Iran on February the 28th has morphed into a slog, despite his non-stop assertions that his ill-defined mission has been accomplished and that the hostilities will wrap up soon. And there are two easy predictions to make when Trump is in a bind. He will never accept responsibility for the consequences of his actions, and he'll always blame a familiar nemesis instead. That's why Trump wants you to focus your fury about the rising cost of gasoline on the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the 32-nation pact known as NATO, that he has spent a solid decade trashing as obsolete. In an interview published April 1st, Trump told British newspaper The Telegraph that NATO is a paper tiger and that he's considering withdrawing America from the alliance. That's because our allies, whom Trump didn't consult before bombing Iran, aren't eager to help him reopen the Strait of Hormuz for oil shipments. This should make for an awkward scene when NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte visits Washington today to meet with Trump, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. Before that meeting, Trump should really check in with Rubio about walking away from NATO. And the president might also want to talk to his Republican allies in the U.S. Senate. Because as much as talk of dropping out of NATO might thrill Trump's old pal, Russian President Putin, there's a serious question of whether he can simply make that call. Rubio, as a Republican senator from Florida, had a documented history of showing strong support for NATO. He successfully pushed in 2022 for passage of a bipartisan joint resolution that he said in a news release would explicitly prohibit any president from withdrawing from NATO without the Senate's advice and consent. That became law in 2023, requiring any president to get support from two-thirds of the Senate's members or an act of Congress to quit NATO. The Senate did not sound eager this past week to leave NATO, which was founded in 1949 to keep in check the post-World War II expansion ambitions of what was then the Soviet Union and now Russia. U.S. Senator Chris Coons, a Delaware Democrat, and U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell, a Kentucky Republican, used their posts as ranking members of the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense to stand by NATO in response to Trump's threat, calling it the most successful military alliance in history. They noted that NATO's Article 5, which says an attack on any member shall be considered an attack against them all, has only been invoked once, and that was after the terrorist attacks here on September the 11th of 2001. Alliance disputes are as old as the alliance itself, Coons and McConnell wrote in a joint statement issued April 1st. Americans are safer when NATO is strong and united. U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, a North Carolina Republican who co-chairs the Senate NATO Observer Group, and U.S. Senator Jean Shaheen of New Hampshire, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, issued their own joint statement in support of NATO on April 2nd. "Let us be clear. Congress will not allow the United States to withdraw from NATO," they wrote, citing Rubio's 2023 law, which they noted clearly states that only Congress can authorize the president to withdraw the U.S. from NATO. That will not happen. Trump also ranted and raved during his first term about abandoning NATO. The Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel in 2020 published an opinion that said a president has exclusive power over treaty withdrawal and that Congress is constitutionally prohibited from intruding on this power, according to a report published this February the 27th by the Congressional Research Service. That report noted that the Congress and the courts are not bound to consider this opinion as authoritative and that there is no directly controlling judicial precedent for this kind of fight. Right-wing publications have been cheering on Trump's threat to NATO, and Russia's government has sounded thrilled that a war with their ally Iran was driving a wedge between America and NATO. Iran shutting down the Strait of Hormuz to cause economic pressure in response to US-Israeli bombs was completely predictable. And Trump, because he needs to keep claiming victory in a war he has not won, can't help but contradict his own arguments here about who is to blame. In his national address on April 1st, Trump tried to sell the Strait of Hormuz as a problem for other countries but not America. He urged our allies to take care of that passage and to grab and cherish it. But in the next breath, the president tried to assure Americans that his war on Iran is coming to a close and that when this conflict is over, the strait will open naturally. So he's demanding that NATO fix a problem but also that it's about to fix itself? Even by Trump's standards, this is absurd. About 20% of the world's oil transits the Strait of Hormuz, and about 80% of it goes to Asian countries. That's a fifth of a product priced in a global market. It doesn't matter where oil comes from or where it goes. If it stops flowing, the price of oil goes up everywhere for everyone. That's the problem Trump created. He didn't have a plan for it, and now he has no solutions. NATO is not to blame for any of that. Trump owns the consequences, no matter what he says. In Money, Push to Ditch Gas Tax Grows Amid the Iran War by Keith Ling. Momentum appears to be building for a push to suspend or eliminate the 18-cent per gallon federal gas tax to help drivers suffering from high prices at the pump due to the Iran war. The largest lobbying group for car makers in Washington, the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, came out in favor of a plan to eliminate the federal gas tax in favor of a new vehicle fee that would be based on the weight of cars. Depending on how long this current global oil shock lasts, I do expect to see a consumer shift towards more fuel-efficient vehicles, said John Bozzella, president of the Alliance, which lobbies for most major automakers such as Ford, General Motors, Stellantis, Honda and Toyota. That's likely to accelerate the insolvency of the Highway Trust Fund, the government's dedicated account to build, fix and maintain America's transportation infrastructure. The comments follow similar statements from President Trump and some U.S. lawmakers that have floated the idea of suspending the federal gas tax to help drivers who are now feeling the pinch at the pump. They also come as the national average gas price rose to $4.09 per gallon on April 3rd, according to the AAA Auto Club. That figure is up from a national average price of $3.10 1 month ago on March the 3rd. The gas tax, you know, people have talked about it, Trump said when he was asked recently if he's considering the idea of suspending the gas tax collected by the federal government since the 1930s. "It's something we have in our pocket if we think it's necessary," he said. A pair of Democratic lawmakers in the U.S. Senate also introduced legislation on March 13th that called for the suspension of the federal gas tax until October the 1st in light of the nation's escalating gas prices. The USA Today Cars team took a look at what it takes to suspend or eliminate the federal gas tax and how likely that is to come to fruition. The federal government has been collecting taxes on every gas purchase made at a US station since the 1930s. The current rate of 18.4 cents per gallon was established by a law passed by Congress in 1993. Transportation funding advocates have lamented the fact that Congress has not moved to increase the gas tax in more than three decades. The gas tax typically is authorized by Congress each time it adopts a federal highway funding bill, because the revenue it generates is used to fund the U.S. Department of Transportation's Highway Trust Fund, which is distributed to states to help pay for road and transit construction projects. The federal gas tax was first established in 1932 at a rate of 1 cent per gallon. It's been increased multiple times since then by Congress, and some lawmakers have called to tie it to inflation as votes to increase taxes have become politically difficult for lawmakers to stomach because of voters. Most states also tack on their own gas taxes to fund local road projects. Bozzella, the Auto Alliance president, noted that traditional gas vehicle market share is down 24 percentage points since 2016. Hybrids were 19% of sales in January of 2026, and he also added that online searches for EVs are up 20% since the war in Iran began. "We might see a shift in the marketplace," he said. "Congress is looking at a five-year highway and transportation funding bill right now. That's the perfect time to consider a policy change that does two things at once, brings down the cost of gas, and shores up the trust fund for our fuel-efficient gas vehicle, hybrid and electric vehicle era. Here's the idea. What if we scrap the federal gas tax and replace it with a single fee on every vehicle based on weight?" Bozzella said his proposed vehicle fee would be like a registration fee, straightforward and easy to collect. The federal gas tax hasn't been increased since 1993, and it only brings in about $40 billion per year at its current level. The federal government typically spends about $60 billion on transportation projects, and infrastructure advocates say the amount is barely enough to maintain the nation's roads and transit systems. Most states also levy their own gas taxes. A suspension or elimination of the federal gas tax would require an act of Congress, since the collection of the levy was authorized by lawmakers and previous highway funding bills. The idea is being floated now because the current federal highway funding bill, which was included in former President Biden's signature bipartisan infrastructure bill that was passed in 2021, is now set to expire on September 30th. The last time Congress took a vote to do anything other than reauthorize the gas tax at its current 18.4 cents per gallon level was 1993. Since the tax was first implemented at a rate of 1 cent per gallon, Congress has voted to increase the fuel levy nine times, according to the Congressional Research Service. News from the 50 states. Alabama Gadsden. The city of Gadsden on April 2nd marked the start of a new expansion at the Gadsden Sports Park, breaking ground on Phase 5 of the Riverfront Complex. In Alaska Anchorage, University of Alaska staff voted to form a union called Coalition of Alaska University Employees for Equity. Arizona Phoenix, an energy task force convened by Governor Katie Hobbs, has outlined plans to expedite new projects to meet demand from data centers and Arizona's semiconductor boom, while keeping the costs of doing so from driving up Arizonans' utility bills. In Arkansas, Little Rock, a recent federal court ruling blocking an executive order to defund public broadcasting is not expected to alter Arkansas's plan to sever ties with PBS. In California, San Francisco, President Trump wants to reopen Alcatraz Island as a modern federal prison, and he's asking Congress for $152 million to start planning the project, according to a proposed 2027 budget request. The proposal, buried in the Department of Justice's budget submission released by the White House, calls for converting the former maximum security prison into a state-of-the-art federal facility. Colorado, Denver. Colorado has marked its third consecutive year of declining auto thefts, with a 34% reduction in 2025 compared to 2024. in Connecticut, New Haven. State scientists issued a warning that tick activity is on the rise. In Delaware City, Delaware, a Delaware mother is suing Delaware City Refinery over pollution she believes impacted her child's health and their ability to enjoy their home. In the District of Columbia, Washington, police said multiple arrests were made after several fights erupted outside the Teen Spring Jam event at the King Greenleaf Recreation Center on April 4th. In Broward County, Florida, the Department of War has confirmed that the secretive March 26 launch at Cape Canaveral Space Force Station was a successful hypersonic missile test. The missile test had not been publicly announced, but it was foreshadowed by a rarely seen Coast Guard Department of Homeland Security launch hazard zone for mariners that stretched over a narrow section of the Atlantic Ocean. In Georgia, Savannah, the Savannah Police Department has unveiled its newly renovated headquarters in the National Historic Landmark District. The 156-year-old building is thought to be one of the oldest continually operating police headquarters buildings in America. In Hawaii, Honolulu, a University of Hawaii study found that farmers in the state face high suicide rates, driven by constant uncertainty and repeated weather-related disasters. In Idaho, Cascade, the Valley County Sheriff's Office said an investigation is underway after thieves stole more than $5,000 in quarters from the Cascade laundromat. In Illinois, Springfield, a Chicago man who opened fire on an Illinois State Police trooper in Springfield in 2023 was sentenced to 95 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections at a 90-minute hearing in a county court on April 3rd. In Indiana, Indianapolis, a country music legends reading initiative has made its way to every Indiana county after fundraising efforts to maintain it. Dolly Parton's Imagination Library is now available in all 92 Indiana counties after a public fundraising drive to keep the program alive in the state. In Ames, Iowa, Iowa State University recently announced Oak View Group will manage and book live events at the various campus venues, as well as the still-in-progress SciTown Entertainment District. Kansas, Salina. Salina Regional Health Center's laboratory has earned reaccreditation from the Accreditation Commission for Healthcare. In Frankfort, Kentucky. Kentucky did not always comply with federal requirements in its use of grant funding for cleanup of former coal mining sites, and in some cases failed to appropriately report or track grant funds. In Louisiana, Baton Rouge, the Louisiana Wildlife and Fisheries Commission announced the 2026 private recreational and state charter red snapper season will open May the 1st in both state and federal waters. In Maine, Piscataquis County, the Maine Department of Transportation said work has begun on the $23 million pavement preservation and improvement project in the county. In Hagerstown, Maryland, St. Mary's Catholic School in Hagerstown has gained national recognition for its commitment to Catholic education. In Worcester, Massachusetts, aiming to prepare professionals to meet the high demand of mental health care, Clark University is launching a graduate degree program in mental health counseling. In Michigan, Lansing, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is closing all four of its Forest Service research and development facilities in Michigan as part of a massive restructuring effort. In Minnesota, St. Paul, around 85% of Minnesota students who entered high school in the fall of 2021 graduated within 4 years. It's a slight increase from the 84.2% graduation rate the year before. In Mississippi, Madison, while ground has already officially been broken on the Arts and Entertainment District known as the Gallery in Madison, actual development construction is expected to get started in the near future. Missouri, Jefferson City. Four state entities are warning the public about the growing presence of a highly potent synthetic opioid found in the state. Nitazenes have been increasingly involved in Missouri overdose deaths in 2024. In Montana, Bozeman, Gallatin College has received a $50,000 grant to teach high school students the importance of cybersecurity. In Lincoln, Nebraska, the 2026 Nebraska statewide groundwater level monitoring report released by the Conservation and Survey Division in the University of Nebraska-Lincoln School of Natural Resources found that groundwater levels continued to decline in 2025. Although the decline generally did not threaten drinking water or irrigation supplies. In Nevada, Carson City, a man is accused of shooting at traffic cameras and sparking fires, then leading deputies on a chase that ended in a crash April the 4th. In New Hampshire, Dover, Hyder Family Hospice House will close within a few weeks, stating the decision reflects dire county finances. New Jersey, Trenton. New Jersey gambling regulators can't prevent prediction market firms like Kalshi from accepting wagers on sports, a federal appeals court ruled. In Carlsbad, New Mexico, the U.S. Geological Survey said a magnitude 4.3 earthquake was reported near Carlsbad on April 6th. In Mount Vernon, New York, an unlicensed funeral director has been indicted on 20 charges related to illegally providing funeral directing services for at least 8 months. Michael Norton is accused of operating an unlicensed funeral director and defrauding New Yorkers out of thousands of dollars between May 2025 and January this year, after a State Department of Health inspection discovered 13 bodies in various states of decomposition and 17 boxes of cremated remains in January. In North Carolina, Hendersonville, the contractor on a major downtown Hendersonville residential construction project is suing the owner to enforce the lien, claiming the company is owed millions for work done over the past 2 years. In North Dakota, Fargo, City Commissioner Michelle Turnberg has announced she's running for Fargo mayor. In Ohio, Massillon, facing chronic staff shortages, the state is pausing admissions to the Indian River Juvenile Correctional Facility, one of Ohio's 3 youth prisons. In Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, the U.S. Supreme Court has rejected calls to hear a pivotal tribal sovereignty case from Oklahoma that could have decided whether some tribal citizens are exempt from paying income tax to the state. In Oregon, Salem, staff at Oregon State Parks failed to complete safety inspections of park buildings and kept inconsistent records of state property, according to an audit. The problems auditors found could risk visitor safety and taxpayer money due to lawsuits and fines if not addressed. And that's all we have time for today with the USA Today. This is Alison Davies wishing you all stay safe and well, and I look forward to reading for you next week. Goodbye.